This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Valparaiso attorney Jim Harper is one of several Northwest Indiana residents who have already announced that they are interested in succeeding Congressman Pete Visclosky. Visclosky, of course, the veteran lawmaker from the 1st District of Indiana, has announced that he is not seeking re-election in 2020. And a number of people have already said that they are interested. And Jim Harper is one of those people. We have him with us today as we are going to start talking with some of the candidates to get their views and the like. Jim Harper, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit first about yourself and about what really and truly interested you in deciding to run for Congressman Visclosky's office. What was your background that people don't know about or should know about?
Absolutely, Chris, and I appreciate you having me on this morning. I am born and raised in Northwest Indiana, so I'm from Valparaiso. I'm an attorney. I went down to IU and Georgetown University for law school. And after I graduated law school, I came back to Indiana and worked for a federal judge for a while. I clerked for a federal judge down in Indianapolis and gained some helpful experience there. And then I actually switched it up a little bit and went to New Orleans, and I worked in the public defender's office there for about 5 years, one of the most underfunded and understaffed public defender's offices in the country, and taught me some really good lessons about the importance of criminal justice reform and of fighting for everybody. I also, during that time, helped to found a national nonprofit law firm, which I still work with, which provides free and reduced cost legal services to veterans around the country, we serve veterans around the country, who are seeking benefits for injuries they served, they obtained, rather, during their service. And we've helped hundreds of people gain millions of dollars in benefits around the country. Now, I'm back up, obviously, in Northwest Indiana. I moved back 5 years ago or so, 6 years ago, and work with my family's law firm in Porter County. There's four of us. You can't shake a stick in Porter County without finding a Harper who's an attorney, and I'm happy to work there. For me, there were a couple things that drove me to want to serve Northwest Indiana in Congress. You know, we've been very well served over the last almost 36 years by Pete Visclosky, who's been a strong fighter for Northwest Indiana. I think as we think about who the next representative is going to be, it's a really exciting opportunity, though, to have a voice in Washington, D.C., who provides a fresh perspective, who's not part of the political establishment. And those are things that I want to provide and believe that I can provide. But I also think that at this time in our country's history, it's important that we have a representative in D.C., who is providing really bold ideas, putting forth really bold ideas and progressive ideas for some of the problems facing this country, like healthcare, like climate change, like the need to hold this president accountable. And I want to advance for and fight for those bold progressive ideas.
Now, I know the last time we talked, you were at the time running as a Democratic Party candidate for Indiana Secretary of State. That was back in 2018. And you obviously have picked up some experience on the campaign trail from that experience. And I'm sure you're able to use every single day of that campaign experience to work as you're running for Congressman Visclosky's nomination and the seat for that hopefully will be his nomination in the primary election. Was there anything in particular that in your experiences with Congressman Visclosky, filling in, working with him, I guess, on the campaign trail some time back, but just Congressman Visclosky's philosophy in general about, I guess, the type of person that he hopes that his successor would be?
Well, I first got to know the congressman when I actually interned in his office during college. I worked there for a summer, and then obviously I followed his work and got to see him a little bit on the campaign trail last year. And, you know, one of the things that sticks out to me, and I think that whoever the representative is, and I hope it's me, can learn from him, is his commitment to public service and his commitment to fighting for everybody in Northwest Indiana, no matter what community they're from, no matter what their background is, no matter what their politics are. Frankly, I think that it's important that we have a representative who treats everybody in the region with respect and treats their ideas and input with respect. You know, the congressman in his announcement saying that he was not going to run for re-election implored his successor, whoever he or she may be, to be for something and not against somebody. And I think that that is very valuable advice for anybody in politics, but particularly for someone who seeks to represent Northwest Indiana and Washington.
from your viewpoint, what do you see as the strong points here in Northwest Indiana, not only of the communities, but of the people in them?
Yeah, we have, you know, this is an incredible community that we live in. And I think sometimes we don't think about that. We don't remind ourselves about that. You know, obviously we have some challenges in Northwest Indiana, but we should be proud of our diversity. You know, we have incredible diversity in this region. We should be proud of that. We should embrace that. We should be proud of our natural resources. You know, the national park is a jewel of Northwest Indiana and something that we should not only be constantly working to preserve and strengthen our lakeshore, but we should be trumpeting that and talking about what a great resource that is. Obviously, we have a strong industry in Northwest Indiana. Our steel industry provides lots of very good-paying jobs for our residents. And, you know, we've got great assets like the South Shore, and we're obviously working, and Peter's been doing this, working to make those better. So I do think that there are a lot of really good things going on in Northwest Indiana. We have our challenges, too, but there are some things that we can build on and take advantage of to continue to make Northwest Indiana better.
I know that in your conversations with other folks here in Northwest Indiana and what you've mentioned, I know also on your Facebook page about your interest in running for Congress, that there are some high priorities that you would like to place, and a couple of them in particular. Let's just go down the list here. Tell us, if you will, what you think are your highest priorities that if you are elected in the primary election and go on to become a congressman, among others in the list, what do you think are the important things that you would push for, that you would fight for if you're elected?
I'll tell you, Chris, as I talk to people, and I've been talking to people in, you know, across the district from Michigan City to Hammond and, you know, cities and towns in between, one of the concerns that I hear most frequently are concerns about healthcare. Not only do we, of course, have, you know, 30 million uninsured people in the country, which is, frankly, just unacceptable. But far too many people have insurance that doesn't cover everything they need or has a deductible that puts services, frankly, out of reach. For instance, yesterday I was in Gary and I talked to a woman who was a retired school teacher, a public school teacher, and she told me that she had insurance that she had gotten through the marketplace. And she had a broken arm, and they wouldn't, you know, and it was going to cost her, I believe, $6,000, and they wouldn't cover that. So for me, making sure that every American has access to quality and affordable, and that's so critical, affordable health care, I believe is a human right, and I believe is something that we need to focus on. A couple other issues that are important to me, and I think have to be priorities, climate change and the climate crisis is something that not only affects us here in Northwest Indiana, although, of course, it does, but it affects the entire world, and we are at an absolutely critical juncture. We are running out of time to take action to reduce our carbon footprint here and around the world, and that's another thing I want to focus on. And the last thing that I'll say, and I wish we didn't have to talk about this, but we do have to talk about the need to hold the president accountable. You know, unfortunately, we found ourselves in a situation where we have a president who I believe has broken the law and is undermining our democratic institutions. And it makes it very hard to focus on the issues that we need to be focusing on that affect people day in and day out when we have that kind of lawlessness in the White House. And so I think that we need to be really decisive in taking action on that and holding this president accountable.
What are your thoughts about, I know we're of course always concerned about having good paying jobs here in Northwest Indiana. That's what Congressman Viscoski has fought for during his terms of office. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, obviously got to be a focus. Anything that we can do to improve the quality of life in this region is critical. I'll tell you, you know, I was born and raised in Porter County, and I moved away for college and for law school and to work for a little while. And I came back. Unfortunately, far too many of my friends from high school didn't come back. And so there are a lot of things that we could focus on to try and improve the quality of life in our region. And obviously, you know, good paying jobs is a critical part of that. You know, we're fortunate to have a strong steel industry in this region. I think that we need a representative who's going to fight to make sure that that we're supporting that industry, that we have fair trade deals. that the trade deals that we have enforceable environmental and labor protections so that our industry is playing on a level playing field. I think it's also critical that we invest in our infrastructure. You know, the infrastructure, not just in this region, but in this country, is crumbling. And if we invest in that, it not only makes Northwest Indiana more attractive for businesses that might be looking to locate here, it also provides jobs in the short term. The last piece of investment that's critical to me is investment in green technology and green infrastructure. You know, I think, as I mentioned before, that climate change is a critical issue. I think morally we need to address it. And investing in green infrastructure and green technology is a win-win on that front.
When you set up your campaign almost 2 years ago, back in 2018, we mentioned running for Indiana Secretary of State, you had that established in 2019, now going into 2020, in setting up another campaign in this respect for running for Congress. What things did you learn in the organization and things that you find are different in running instead of for a statewide office and now for Congress?
Well, I'll tell you what. Only having to drive around 2.5 counties as opposed to 92 is a nice change. So I get to sleep in my bed every night. That's a real perk of this campaign. But I learned an awful lot last year. You know, if you run as a Democrat statewide in Indiana, that is a challenge. And I think I took quite a bit away from that. But at the end of the day, I think if you run any campaign, you know, what's important. And what you learn, what I hope that I've learned, is the importance of listening to people, of sitting down and having conversations with people from different, diverse communities to hear about the concerns that they have and the need to really spend the time and effort and energy getting out and having those conversations and making sure that people have the opportunity to meet you and talk with you and hear what you're about. So that you're not only informed about their concerns, but they know what your worldview is and what you'd like to do in Washington. I think those you know, needs and demands are the same, whether it's a statewide campaign or whether it's, you know, a campaign just in Northwest Indiana. There are things that we're going to focus on in this race.
I know one organization is getting things set up for a town hall meeting this week with you as the speaker. Indivisible Northwest Indiana is organizing this town hall meeting. It's going to happen on Wednesday, December 11th. It's going to happen at the Munster Library Branch, the Lake County Public Library Branch in Munster. Tell us a little bit about your feelings about being involved with the groups that like Indivisible Northwest Indiana that in turn want to be sure to get the word out, not only about you, but I'm sure other candidates as well.
Yeah, we're really excited about the opportunity to talk with people who are active not only in Indivisible, but just in the community generally. You know, Indivisible is one of those great groups that has become very active since the 2016 election. And had some the leaders of it obviously had some very understandable concerns about what happened in the 2016 election and the need to get people engaged. You know, I've worked to reach out to other groups that are working to get people engaged in the civic process. For instance, we've been at League of Women Voters meetings. There's a great group in Northwest Indiana called Rise Northwest Indiana that's working to promote civic engagement. And I've met with them and had the opportunity to hear about the good work that we're doing. You know, it's something that's particularly important to me. It's part of the reason why, and you mentioned the Secretary of State's race, I ran for that. What for some people is maybe an obscure office. It's the chief elections officer in Indiana. Issues of voting, of making sure that our election system works well, that we improve our voter turnout in this country, and that we have an election system that's fair and representative of people's desires are critically, critically important to me. And so I'm excited about engaging with those grassroots organizations like Indivisible, which is doing great work, having the opportunity to have conversation and discourse with League Women Voters, groups like Rise, Indivisible, is something that I am very passionate about because we want to run a grassroots campaign, and I think that's what the people of Northwest Indiana, deserve.
Well, Jim Harper, thank you for spending time with us here on Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about yourself and about the campaign, about the office that you're seeking to succeed Congressman Pete Fiskoski. And we hope to have a chance to have you back on to talk more often as the campaign goes on into 2020.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. You're listening to Jim Harper. He is an attorney in Valparaiso, and he is one of the people who's interested in running on the Democratic Party ticket in the primary election coming up next year for a 1st District Congressman to succeed Congressman Pete Visklosky. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The federal government announced a push last year to end the HIV epidemic. The virus, which was once a death sentence for many Americans, can now be managed and prevented through medical advances. But it will take more than just a pill to stop the spread of HIV. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on a one-stop-shop model that helps close the gaps for care for Hoosiers.
Bags are being packed at the food pantry inside the Damien Center in Indianapolis. Sam McHenry has been volunteering his time here for more than 20 years.
We do a strong emphasis on the protein, beans, and then the frozen meats.
It's important to get enough protein, especially if you're HIV positive. McHenry likely contracted the human immunodeficiency virus in the mid-80s, but didn't find out until 1992.
My infectious disease doctor told me I would live possibly a year to year and a half at most. I'm very stubborn.
McHenry says he lost his eyesight to complications from HIV, but he's still able to live a healthy, productive life. The Damien Center has helped.
The care coordination was very helpful in providing me with support or support groups and things like of that nature.
For McHenry, that coordination of support was key. Others face different challenges: a lost job, eviction, or mistrust of the healthcare system. The Damien Center makes its home in an old brick building that was once an Indianapolis school. Every inch of the space is utilized.
We try to be a one-stop shop. We offer everything from direct medical care to housing, transportation, food, case management, mental health care, psychiatric care, substance use, treatment, all under one roof.
Alan Witchie is president and CEO of Damien. He says having all those social services in a single space improves the chances that people will receive care, no matter what the barrier. One barrier is simply finding out your status, which he says Damien offers free HIV testing to anyone.
You would think that would make it so much easier to know everyone's status in the city, but what we do know is there are at least probably about 1,000 people in this city that are HIV positive who don't know it.
Indiana has about 500 new cases of HIV every year, and most new transmissions are from people who don't know they have the virus, which he says a lot of that is because people simply don't know the facts.
There's a lot of myths that people still think they might die, they might get very sick from their medications, they might not ever be able to live a normal lifespan, and all those things are not true anymore.
People who are HIV positive can take medication that can effectively reduce the amount of the virus in their blood to undetectable. There's also preventative medication called PrEP that protects from HIV. The Damien Center helps people get on the proper drugs. But that's just one piece of the puzzle to end the epidemic. Tyne Parlett is housing manager at Damien Center and says many clients have more basic needs, and the center is able to provide for those and more.
So that we aren't just turning people away after having a blood draw or getting them on PrEP and being able to insure them for one medication but sending them somewhere else, or being able to house them but not being able to get them a bed.
Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar made a trip to the Damien Center recently to check out their wraparound model of care. Indianapolis was named as one of 48 hotspots that will receive federal support to address HIV services. Parlett says, while Damien offers education and support, it can't end the stigma that impacts many clients.
So we're talking about your social support now being gone. We're talking about maybe housing now being something that you can't secure. We're talking about literal criminalization for some of our trans sex workers that are out there.
Sam McHenry, the Damien volunteer, says to end the epidemic, it will take more. More education, more awareness, more understanding.
It's living healthy and living strong.
The federal push to end the epidemic aims to reduce new cases by 75% in 5 years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Across the United States, more than 2,000 people have reported vaping-related lung illnesses, and 47 people have died. Some vaping happens in schools, so they share the burden of bringing this crisis under control, which raises the question, what should the consequences be for a student caught vaping? Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett takes a look at the answers to the question.
Some of these devices look like a flash drive, no bigger than a couple of inches. The smoke or vapor they release has little to no smell. Basically, they're really easy to hide and are a nightmare for educators.
New at 6, a student is expelled from school after getting sick from vaping.
In Spencer Owen Community Schools, about an hour south of Indianapolis, a high school student got sick this fall after vaping a marijuana-laced e-cigarette. He went to the school nurse and was reported to other school officials. Here's the student's mother, Shannon Houck, on RTV6.
How are we supposed to, you know, tell our children, you know, if you have a medical problem, even if it is smoking a vape in school, and I understand that he, you know, did wrong by doing that, but we're teaching them, don't go to the school, you know, officials, don't go to the nurse, because you could get in trouble.
And that's an important question here, because more kids are vaping than ever before. And now there's a debate over how to handle these students. Spencer Owen Community School says it followed policy. And in most Indiana school districts, a student who vapes in school would be suspended or expelled after one or more instances. I asked Dr. Sarah Boslett about this. She's the past president of Indiana's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and says adults think this kind of discipline policy will work.
But anyone who's raised a teenager knows that that's not an effective strategy. Teenagers are frustrating and impulsive, and what they respond best to is what's hardest. Individual attention, and extra effort when they are at risk.
In her practice, Boslett sees students vaping by sixth grade. And she says suspending these students can lead to more dangerous behavior, like vaping at home or using drugs.
And the worst thing you can do is isolate them and exclude them from activities that keep them busy and engaged and connected to their peers.
She says there should be some kind of consequence for vaping, community service, additional education. But Boslett and others argued that suspension isn't the answer.
Yeah, I think school nurses see themselves as the leader on the forefront of this as a health problem.
Deborah Barge, executive director of Indiana Association of School Nurses, told me she's worried about how this sort of discipline can affect students.
That we want them to get their education. We don't want them to lose out on opportunities they have only as a child because they've gotten caught up in this craze, which is just so popular.
Is this a public health issue or is this a discipline issue? You know,
so I think it's somewhere in between. And I've tried to kind of poll nurses across Indiana, but also across the country. I think what a lot of school nurses are feeling like, it's a mixture.
I'm at Beech Grove Senior High School in Indianapolis, and students dash between classes. Principal Liz Walters says about once a week or so, they catch students with e-cigarettes like those made by Juul. She says students caught the first time face an in-school suspension. That means they have to complete educational materials on vaping, and their parents are included too. They can also be connected to counseling. For a second offense, they'll be suspended out of school.
You'd be hard-pressed to find any school that was not, you know, sort of supplementing those resources with some type of school punishment.
Still, Walter says striking this balance between discipline and help for students is a tough daily conversation. Principals and teachers realize schools are very structured, and at home, students may have much more freedom.
But then eventually, we have to make sure that students recognize they cannot continue to do things in a school environment that is detrimental to the school environment. And that's hard. That is very hard.
Some help for schools might be on the way. Raising the age to buy e-cigarettes and tobacco products from 18 to 21 will be at the forefront of the 2020 Indiana legislative session. A similar federal law has also been proposed. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
Doesn't matter whether it happened to have been seen from the foxhole or from a cockpit of an aircraft, maybe seen from a ship deck or maybe even from a mess deck or even still from a behind-the-scenes office desk. They're all stories that deserve to be told and to be chronicled. And that's what the Veterans History Project is all about. And we have with us the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, now retired Colonel Karen Lloyd. Colonel Lloyd, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, Chris, thanks for having me. Very much appreciated.
If you will, please take a moment and talk a little bit about the Veterans History Project. How did it get started, and what are some of the general goals that you have?
Well, the Veterans History Project was started in October 2020. It was led by Representative Ron Kine, who had the idea based on a picnic he had had the previous summer with his family when his dad and uncle got together and started talking about their story. And he said, you know, who else out there needs to know these stories? Mm-hmm. And the Veterans History Project really relies on volunteers like your listeners to reach out to the veterans in their lives and their communities to find out what they did, whether it was humorous, whether it was harrowing. It's these stories that are lost to history unless we find out what they are and get them somehow jotted down or listened to and recorded. And that's what we're all about, helping your listeners, volunteers, reach out to those veterans who would otherwise be lost in plain sight.
What do you see as the reason why veteran stories seem to be our stories in general?
I think veteran stories are our stories because they help us understand that these are folks from across all backgrounds, experiences, walks of life, and they have served our country, and they really prove why freedom's not free.
Now, we know that many times this is an opportunity for folks to do a little research, not only about individual research into a family member or maybe somebody from the community that they live in, but just in general, researchers taking advantage of this. How does the collection is able to be used as a research tool?
Well, the collection is used by a variety of different folks. I mean, two that really come to my mind. One is Ken Burns when he did his World War II documentary back in 2008, mm-hmm. and then again when he did his Vietnam documentary in 2017. Both times he used over 200 of our collections to look at stories and listen to stories to see which stories he wanted to use. But what I like best about it is that the veterans keep their copyright with our program so that Ken Burns had to reach out to these veterans or their heirs and say, I'd like to use your story. Here's how I'd like to use your story. Are you up for it? Another really good example would be Liza Mundy and the book that she wrote, Code Girls, the World War II women who were told, oh, well, just tell them you're a government secretary, and they were the ones that were breaking the codes. And what I'm most pleased about is Liza said, if not for your research librarian and for the materials you had here at the library, I would not have done this book because I wouldn't have thought I had enough materials. And what I'm most pleased about is that last March, we actually had the first national Code Girl reunion here at the library, and we had six Code Girls in their mid-90s come, along with over 40 family members.
Wow.
To talk about what their loved ones did during the war.
Take a second and explain to our listeners, if they're not familiar with the term Code Girl, what does that mean?
Code Girls were the women that were asked, are you going to be engaged, and are you good at crossword puzzles? Mm. And if they weren't going to be engaged and they were good at crossword puzzles, they were breaking the codes. One of the codes that they broke was the Japanese purple box, which allowed us to be successful at Midway. And these women didn't talk to each other. Some of the stories that Liza shared with us that I absolutely adore was she said her husband and her children and her went into an intelligence museum, a spy museum, if you will, mm-hmm. and they saw a purple, this coding machine. It was the Japanese equivalent of the Enigma. And she said, oh, well, I guess I can tell you what I did during the war. And his husband says, well, dear, you were a government secretary. And she said, no, Harold, here's what I really did. So she explained to Harold and their grown children what she had done during the war breaking codes, and she had never shared that before because she felt like if she did, that she would go to jail.
Wow.
And there's a whole group of women whose stories went with them to the grave because they didn't believe they could tell their stories. And we're so grateful for the few that chose to do that. We have over 20, and Liza found even more. But what they did was absolutely amazing, and they got absolutely no recognition for it. They're starting to get recognition now, which is so rewarding to me.
Now, we talked a little bit about the collections that are there available in the Veterans History Project and people that can take advantage of it. First, let's talk first about how veterans and Gold Star families can kind of add to their stories from the collections.
Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned Gold Star Families. 2 years ago, well, and actually 3 years ago in 2016, the end of 2016, Congress passed a law that allowed us to increase our mission to include Gold Star Families so that we can now hear from the loved ones of those that pay the ultimate sacrifice. Mm-hmm. We have 79 collections now, and it's growing daily. What I'm most pleased about is on Friday we had Navy Senior Petty Officer Keith Sherman, who has been going around the country, and he's collected a Gold Star family story from every state, and he chose to donate them to us here at the Library of Congress and the Veterans History Project, and we couldn't be more pleased about that. And your viewers can go up loc.gov/vets or our email site, vohp@loc.gov, to learn more about what we're doing, and you know, email us if what they see there isn't what they want. We will reach out to folks across the nation and provide, at no cost to them, a trained oral historian to help them gain a new skill set. We also have field kits that say how to do it. And if you have a tablet or a smartphone, you're halfway there. And we also have sample questions so that people will have a sense of, you know, how do you do an interview? What are the questions you should be asking? Some of my favorite questions, quite frankly, as a part of that arc of the story, is when you ask the veteran, so how did, one, why the heck did you sign up? And then followed by, so how did you get from home to that first duty station? And for some vets, it's the first plane ride, train ride, or bus they ever took. And then the most fun, quite frankly, is when you say, and who at that first duty station made the biggest impression on you, made a difference in your life? And they all remember the name. They all say, oh, my God, Sergeant Brown. And then they'll go and talk about it. And their eyes light up because it's something that they probably haven't talked about in an awfully long time.
Colonel Lloyd, thank you for the information. Once again, give us the web address so if anybody wants to find out more about not only what's out there, but also to be able to get the information and contribute to it. What's the address for the Veterans History Project?
Yes, our website is loc.gov/vets with an S.
And we've been talking with retired Army Colonel Karen Lloyd. She is the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, which tells stories because veteran stories are our stories, too. A chance is open for residents to get the training needed to be ready for the Hard Rock Casino jobs coming to Gary. We had a chance recently to talk with Dee Dee White with Ivy Tech Community College, Lake County, about the courses that are offered that can lead to these new jobs. This was planned long before that the word finally came out about the new on-land casino in Gary, but this has to be a perfect time to find out about the possibility of what could be hundreds of new jobs and the fact that there are many people that will need to be trained for these jobs out there and how Ivy Tech can fit into all of this.
We are doing casino dealer training at Ivy Tech. This is what we call an open enrollment class where we're inviting anybody from the public to come in and learn how to be a dealer. We're offering both blackjack training and craps training. They're considered non-credit classes, but if somebody wants to continue their education in a hospitality pathway, we can actually crosswalk these classes into credit so that they can, you know, ultimately start with a few credits in a hospitality pathway.
That's very important because that's the gateway, I suppose, certainly to better jobs and may even get somebody a good initial job to be sure if you have that that hospitality degree.
For sure. But, you know, the nice thing is the casino dealers, they make a very good wage. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, they're anywhere between $38,000 to $40,000 a year.
Of course, it's going to be set up not only to train people about the games themselves, too, but also that you're setting up an opportunity that if the student happens to complete the course, that they'll at least get a chance to be interviewed, I understand.
You bet. We have it set up right now where they will definitely be interviewed by at least one casino. Mm-hmm. In the casino business, it's actually called an audition. So they will have at least one audition with a casino.
What kind of work in particular to set up the course itself? How much work did you have at Ivy Tech Community College to be able to do, to be able to get the casinos interested in this, and, of course, people involved in helping train them?
You know what? It's all about community. You know, it's all about collaborating and just finding out where those high-demand jobs are. And when you look across, you know, so you go from Joliet all the way to New Buffalo in Michigan. Mm-hmm. That's about a hundred mile area right there. There are thousands of jobs, across that area just in casinos. Now, it's not all dealer jobs, But, you know, dealer jobs, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of jobs that are available, and again, at that higher wage. So, you know, the work that went into getting this training going again, it was just all a collaborative effort on, you know, just figuring out, like I said, where those jobs are and, you know, finding instructors and getting the equipment we need, like, you know, tables and, you know, the blackjack tables and craps tables. And so this is all going to be housed at our East Chicago location here at our Ivy Tech Lake County campus. The blackjack training is an 8-week course. It'll run 4 hours a day, Monday through Friday. And then our craps course is a 10-week course, and that will also run 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And they'll be offered at different times. So we're going to do, you know, we'll try some day classes that will be very family-friendly as far as, you know, if we have folks that have children that want to, you know, take care of their kids in the morning, you know, get them off to school, and then come in for the training. We'll do like a 9-to-1 or a 10-to-2 training so that they could be home for their kids in the afternoon. There are also possible scholarship opportunities for students and the tuition. All they'd have to do is, you know, get in touch with us, and then we'll get them in touch with the people in the community that may be willing to sponsor them. We also have possible daycare, free daycare in place for some of the participants.
Tell us a little bit about the instructors. You have to have certain specialties in this particular case, people who are very, very trained in not only the games but how casinos work, don't you?
You bet. So we already have in line qualified instructors to teach these classes. These are people that have worked or currently work at casinos, so they understand, you know, they understand that environment. They obviously understand the games. They've trained in the past. So we're really excited about the folks that we have in place.
Well, enrollment's underway right now for Ivy Tech Community College courses, and this one in particular dealing with the casino dealer training that's going to happen at the East Chicago location. If anybody's interested, how can they find out more information now?
Yeah, so they can call the Lake County Campus Workforce Alignment Division at 219-981-4402, or they can email us at nwcorporatecollege@ivytech.edu.
Northwest Indiana cybersecurity business is getting some important international recognition this year. Maryville-based SimCorp Incorporated is one of only two Midwest companies that have been listed as one of the top 150 cybersecurity companies to watch in 2020 by Cybercrime Magazine. SimCorp's president and CEO Robert Johnson III talks about the company, what it does to protect business and industry, and being named to the top 150 companies to watch list.
We actually started in 1997, and initially we were focused on doing process automation and control, and that was actually automating manufacturing facilities. Mm-hmm. And while working in that space, one of the opportunities that we identified was that it seemed like it was possible without much effort to jeopardize the integrity of the manufacturing process or those critical machines that actually run our processes. So that encouraged us to develop the first version of our software, which at the time was called SimTrack Industrial, and the name of our product in general is called SimTrack. And that product helped identify unexpected changes to systems that help run manufacturing processes, those specialized computer systems.
Were you finding back then in these early days of the company that, and since you're talking about industrial processes, that these were probably processes that might have been put onto, we'll just say, a floppy disk? You know, the technology was very simple back then compared to what it is now. It was not as much on the internet-based systems as we have today, was it?
Not quite. But still, you had some of these control system networks being connected to the internet.
Right.
You also, and really the threat point at the time were USB sticks and laptops being carried throughout the organization. And what was the possibility that that laptop was infected and somehow altering, you know, how those manufacturing processes actually worked? Now, we ended up morphing over time and extending outside of that process automation realm into the general enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that was a big shift for us. But the mentality stayed the same. You know, we've always been of the mind that processes are critical and mission critical, in fact. And because of that, when we developed our software and targeted towards the general enterprise, this had that same thought process. How do we ensure business continues to run?
Did you find that over the years that you branched out from industrial into other business ventures that the problem was still there? In fact, it got worse because of the fact that it was so easy to break into systems and infect them somehow or another. And did you find that there wasn't any real difference between, say, the processes in a factory or a manufacturer as to those in, say, in a major business?
No. The problem was really the same. And what we do is we actually detect unexpected changes to devices and servers and network devices. And if it changes, we let you know about it. And then here's where this process automation mentality kicks in.
Yeah.
We can automatically fix it, and our software can change things back to how they actually were before the attack. You mentioned things morphing over time. You know, I remember when we started, we were looking at about 78,000 threats a day, new types of malware, new types of threats every day. And but then about 2014, we hit 348,000 new types of malware, new threats a day. And as of today, we're well beyond 1.2 million new variants of malware every day.
Do you find that these are new ideas, or that the whoever's out there hacking, finding ways to break into the systems? Or do you find just maybe different versions of the same sort of malware that has developed over time?
That's a good question. It's actually a combination of both. There are always new ideas out there and new ways to exploit systems. However, we've also hit this point in time where there's an entire economy that's based around actually selling malware that can be customized by the purchaser, the person purchasing that tool may not have a high level of technical ability. So now this has become, you know, becoming more of a commodity to an extent.
Now, how did Cybersecurity Ventures, the organization that put SimCorp Incorporated on the latest list, the hot 150 cybersecurity companies in the world in 2020, how did they find out about you folks, and how did they in turn determine that you were best suited for the list this year?
Well, Cybersecurity Ventures does an analysis of the entire security market. So their analysts and folks are constantly reaching out to understand your product, how it fits into the security space, and a problem that it solves. So this entire process is based on merit, and they take into consideration not only the leadership, the innovation in the company, but they also speak with customers and analysts to help make that final determination.
Now, how did Cybersecurity Ventures, in turn, they found out about you? Certainly by keeping an eye on businesses, probably from recommendations from other businesses. How do you rank with the big boys out there, seeing as I guess your company, and there's one other company I noted on the list that's based in Minneapolis. So you have only two in the entire Midwest, and then we have a number of course, in the United States and around the world. How did it come out that you're on the list this year?
Well, I'm happy to be part of that short list. Mm-hmm. But you're right; most of the companies on that list are quite large, and but we've been holding our own. I think that we have a culture of innovation at SimCorp, and a lot of that's driven just by the general culture to me in the Midwest, particularly here in Northwest Indiana.
Did you find Northwest Indiana as being not only a good place to establish a business, but to be able to grow over time? Because I suppose you could have taken your business to Chicago, or you could have been in one of the suburbs, but Northwest Indiana is where you're based.
Right. Well, I grew up here in Northwest Indiana, and you know, the easiest path for would have been to, you know, start a business out in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But we really wanted to make an impact here in Northwest Indiana. We're trying to make this shift from a manufacturing economy to a services type of economy, and we can only do that if we all individually participate in making that possible. And on top of it all, if you look at the resources that we have right here in Northwest Indiana, the human resources, they're really outstanding.
Cybercrime Magazine chose SimCorp Incorporated for the 2020 Top 150 Companies to Watch list because of its specialized software. It's time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Don Parker, a favorite guest over the years.
Once again,
Don Parker is a board member and musician with the South Shore Orchestra based out of Valparaiso. Mm-hmm. And you've been with all the orchestras. You have every community theater group, certainly.
Not Northwest, though.
Not Northwest
the
Indiana.
The schedule Symphony. When I first moved to this area long ago just didn't work for
I
me.
I see. So, but... Well, you just need, and you would have to join the union.
Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Heavy duty stuff. Okay. Well, Don, it's great to have you here. Well, speaking of which, are South Shore Orchestra musicians paid or are you all volunteers?
We are. Pay a stipend, yeah, essentially, for the musicians because we recognize that their time is valuable. It has value. And but we do have both professional and amateur musicians as well as student apprentices. So,
okay.
And the student apprentices also receive pay for
how many
work.
Members of the orchestra are there?
I like to say we're kind of a repertory group, which means we put together the ensemble that we need for the works that or program that we're doing. So we can range anywhere from 30 to 85 musicians, we can put together a full symphony orchestra.
Are auditions for the orchestra held at one time of the given time of the year or ongoing?
As needed,
yeah,
ongoing.
As needed, cool. Well, you have your big, as everybody does, you have your big holiday concert coming up fairly soon, Friday, December 20th. Tell us
Memorial
about
Opera House.
Yeah.
Memorial Opera House, and we established a partnership about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's been just a wonderful partnership. It's a great setting, and we usually do 2 or 3 concerts a year at MOH, and this one will be we like to change up stuff a little bit. You'll have all of the typical Christmas programming. We'll have sing-alongs to carols. We'll have Leroy Anderson's Sleigh Ride and other old favorites. But our music conductor, Troy Webdell, also likes to program things that people don't know that have a Christmas theme. And I think that's a that's one of the joys of doing something like this, especially for the musicians, so that you're always playing something that you've never played before, and it's a challenge. We are doing Otterino Respighi's Can-Can from the Magic Toy Shop. It's a suite that he did with a holiday or Christmas theme. And we're doing the Snow Buffoons by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov as well. So,
and that sounds fun.
Yeah,
too.
And I don't know that piece at all, but being a Rimsky-Korsakov, I assume it's really exciting and high energy.
The
Snow Buffoons.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, I love that. So how many people does the Opera House seat?
Seats about 300.
Okay, and so are you doing just one performance?
Just one performance, and you should try to get your tickets early because that one usually sells out, yes.
Yeah, I would think so. Wow, that is, those are premium seats then. Mm-hmm. And it's such a charming setting, too.
It is. It's just a great place. Once they decorate that up for the holidays, it just really gets you into the spirit of the season.
And what I know that you do some really interesting – well, how many concerts do you do per year?
Typically 2, sometimes 3 there at the Opera House. And then other concerts as well, other settings.
And other settings, including – China. You've been to China a number of times.
The group's been to China 5 times and also took a USO tour program 1 year to China, which was a big success as well.
Do you have any plans like that, travel plans like that for the orchestra
Not soon upcoming. We hope to again, but not soon.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting that musicians from Northwest Indiana get to get to have an experience like that. Our youth orchestra for the Northwest Indiana Symphony went to Italy a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And that's a thrilling thing for
young
people.
Sure. Exactly.
So you have that that as well. Well, Don, any other last words you'd like to share with us about the South Shore Orchestra?
Come and enjoy the holiday season in a wonderful, warm setting there at the Opera House with us.
And get your tickets right away.
And get your tickets
now. Coming
up
on Friday, December the 20th.
Yes.
Just
7:30.
Perfect time. Well, good luck with the concert, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, John.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And again, John King was talking with Don Parker with the South Shore Orchestra about the December 20th performance of Holiday Pops. And you'd hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online on our website right now, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And join us again next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, we will continue our conversations with the citizens who want to become members of Congress. They're candidates in the Democratic Party primary election next year for the seat that is being vacated by Pete Fisklosky. Our next candidate to talk to is Sabrina Hake. We hope you'll join us for that conversation tomorrow.